Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Barbara Olshansky, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who takes a critical look at the FBI's surveillance of anti-war activists and the chilling effect these activities have on free speech. Jerry Reed, whose son Cody is serving with the U.S. military in Iraq, reflects on President Bush's surprise Thanksgiving visit to Baghdad and the dangers American troops face daily in that embattled nation. And Winona Howder, Director of Public Citizens Energy and Environmental Program, who discusses the grassroots movement that stopped congressional passage of an energy bill which many activists believe to be harmful to the environment and a giveaway to industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Little noticed in Africa's litany of civil wars is the growing level of death and destruction in northern Uganda. In just one incident in early September, anti-government rebels torched a bus, killing 22 people. According to the World Press Review magazine, this is just the latest chapter in the 17-year armed rebellion against Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. The rebels, the Lord's Resistance Army, is well known for its cruelty, including telling recruits to cut off victims' lips, ears, noses, or other limbs. The LRA leader, Joseph Kony, blends a bizarre mix of Christian fundamentalism and African animism, with the ultimate goal of creating a tribal state based on the Ten Commandments. In response to the latest round of LRA attacks, new pro-government tribal militias have been organized. Health Minister Mike Mukula praised the militias for saving the lives of 500 children who were detained by the rebels. Still, many critics fear the militias will bring a new reign of warlordism, such as existed in Somalia and Liberia over the last decade. The historic ruling by the Massachusetts Supreme Court to legalize gay marriage is being felt in states across the country. According to the Boston Globe, gay marriage is suddenly on the top of the political agenda in states as diverse as New Jersey, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Nevada. However, social conservatives are pressing for a federal constitutional amendment that bans same-sex marriage. The most immediate result of the ruling is an upsurge in donations to gay rights groups like the Human Rights Campaign. In a single week after the gay marriage ruling, HRC raised $155,000 for a national media campaign to promote recognition of same-sex couples. In Arizona, a same-sex marriage bill is also headed to the state Supreme Court, where over 800 conservatives recently met in Phoenix to push for a state constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. Additionally, anti-gay forces in the state have lined up the support of Legislative Speaker Jake Flake, who calls marriage a sacred institution between a man and a woman. Social conservatives in Nevada are hoping to use the Massachusetts gay rights decision to boost the prospects of right-wing activist Richard Zisser in his uphill campaign against moderate Democrat Senator Henry Reid. Over the last decade, Walmart, the world's largest retailer, has dominated both suburban and rural markets, in part by keeping wages low and working to quash any union attempt to organize its workforce. But as the huge discounter seeks to enter urban centers, it faces a new obstacle: the proliferation of 110 living wage ordinances in northern cities and in California, where Walmart has yet to establish itself. According to The Nation magazine, big box stores like Target have been successful in getting around local living wage laws. In St. Paul, Minnesota, the city council waived its living wage regulation as part of a deal granting Target $6.3 million in subsidies for the retailer to develop a downtown department store. In Hartford, Connecticut, community and union activists are working to make sure the local living wage law is enforced on Walmart. Next summer, the discounter hopes to break ground on a 165,000-square-foot store on land currently owned by the Hartford Housing Authority. Yet Hartford's officials are trying to avoid any conflict with Walmart. The city's economic development director says Walmart's wages should meet the living wage law, but, he explains, the law would not apply because of what some critics charge is a phony exemption set up by Walmart supporters in city government. If that decision stands, the teeth would be taken out of the living wage law. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
When the Bush administration made public its goal to invade and overthrow the government of Saddam Hussein in the summer of 2002, peace activists across America began organizing opposition to the coming war. Using the internet and alternative media to spread the word, hundreds of new local and national anti-war groups were formed, and in just a few short months came together by the hundreds of thousands to demonstrate against the march to war. The corporate media initially marginalized their coverage of the anti-war protests until the numbers of people in the streets were just too big to ignore. But the Federal Bureau of Investigation, it appears, maintained a keen interest in these groups from the beginning. A recently leaked confidential FBI memorandum details how government agents have collected information on the tactics, training, and structure of legal peace organizations and enlisted local police departments to become their eyes and ears in monitoring these groups. Recent press reports citing the FBI memo have confirmed what activists and civil liberties advocates have long suspected about government surveillance of constitutionally protected political activities. In an echo of the many documented abuses of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, the Bureau justifies their actions by declaring that spying on the president's political opponents is simply part of the government's post-September 11th anti-terrorism measures. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Barbara Olshansky, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who takes a critical look at the FBI's surveillance of dissidents and the chilling effect it has on free speech.
Several weeks ago, the FBI came out saying that they had collected extensive information on the tactics and training and organization of anti-war demonstrators. That was the first that we had known that they were actually doing this, you know, out of their own mouths. But even prior to that, when we heard first about the no-fly list, which some folks might be familiar with, that also gave us hints of that this was going on, because that was clearly also aimed at anti-war protesters. People from the peace movements all across the country were being targeted and stopped at airports and either prevented entirely from flying or had their identification seized and were told that they needed to be evaluated before they were going to be permitted to go on their way to these meetings. And it was very clear then that it was aimed at anti-war protesters. So all of this has sort of been in the offing. And then, you know, then what happens is we hear about, in fact, that there's actually a policy on the books that's actually targeting people that are engaged in lawful protests and dissent. And so, you know, what we had watched sort of unfold, you know, really was just then put out there more specifically for public consumption. And so it's really something that we were watching for, and we sort of hate to jump to those conspiratorial conclusions, and then, of course, it gets confirmed for us by the federal government.
What do you think the FBI is looking for, given that, by and large, these demonstrations have been peaceful with hardly any incidents of violence that I can recall reading about, or any nonviolent civil disobedience? Very little of that as well, which is, you know, certainly in the tradition of Martin Luther King and Gandhi.
Well, right. I mean, in fact, for all the different major anti-war demonstrations, there has been no violence at all. One of the things we first thought is, well, you know, the Patriot Act has a very broad definition of what constitutes terrorism. And we thought, well, you know, that definition includes violent acts that are intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. That's the language. And we thought, well, you know, maybe they're going to try and paint all of the civil rights groups as terrorist groups by saying that they're undertaking these violent acts, except you're right. They've been very, very peaceful. So it was clear that they really couldn't use the Patriot Act as a hook. And instead what's happened is the FBI has advised local law enforcement officials basically to keep tabs on who is attending these different meetings, what groups are attending, what their views are, and to start taking interviews. And in New York, this manifested itself several months ago with arrests of protesters, not for civil disobedience, but I guess there was no police activity that said, you know, you need to disperse. And so they just arrested people, and they started interrogating them about their political beliefs. And we pretty quickly put a stop to that. But that was clearly part of what the FBI is advising local law enforcement officials to do, which is basically look at who is participating, which groups, which individuals are leading the participations, what activities they're undertaking, and basically to try and identify people that they think are extremist elements. you know, that really harkens back to those old days where anyone that is protesting what the government is doing is suspect. And all of these people are, you know, doing exactly what is, you know, sort of the hallmark of democracy, voicing their opinion about what our government is doing. And while we're, you know, supposedly trying to sow the seeds of democracy in the Middle East, we're undermining it right here on our own soil. It's just, you know, sort of an amazing admission by the government that this is going on.
What does the Center for Constitutional Rights and other groups like the American Civil Liberties Union intend to do on citizens' behalf about the abuse and potential abuse of these surveillance powers that the FBI has taken onto themselves, spying on legal organizations?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're doing with other groups like the ACLU and others is challenging these policies in court. We're also encouraging people to email, call, fax, write, and just generally scream at the people that they put into office to let them know that this isn't okay. There's lots of groups that are writing petitions, that are lobbying people in Congress to let them know. There are Bill of Rights defense committees that are started in each city across the country. People should really feel free to go to their city council, their town council, their county and state legislatures, and get these resolutions passed so that it's clear that from the ground up, Americans don't agree with these policies. Really, what this means is that they've taken advantage of our sort of not having such a big political role in our lives anymore in this country because, you know, things seem to operate on their own. And now, you know, now it's incumbent upon all of us to take it back. We need to make it known to everyone that we talk to, from the people in our town and city councils to the people that we elect to Congress, that this can't be done in our name. This is not what we want. This is not where we want this country to go, and we're not going to let it happen. And I think that's what people have to do. I tell people, you know, if you're going to the supermarket, when you pick up a melon and you ask, you know, your neighbor, is this ripe, you should say, and do you know what John Ashcroft is doing to this country? Let me tell you. Because that's the level at which we have to start organizing.
That was Barbara Olshansky, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org. President Bush's surprise Thanksgiving trip to Iraq was intended, his advisor said, to boost the morale of American troops confronting an increasingly dangerous assignment. But the extreme secrecy with which the president's two-and-a-half-hour visit to the Baghdad airport was carried out underscored the combat conditions and lack of security that persist in much of Iraq. Critics accused the president of taking unnecessary risks for what was essentially a photo opportunity, whose staged managed images will undoubtedly be used in his reelection campaign. While Mr. Bush attempted to use his trip to Iraq as a way to briefly deflect criticism of his handling of the war, U.S. soldiers continued to die in the conflict that he had declared was over on May 1st. A recent battle between American troops and insurgents in the Iraqi city of Samarra was originally characterized by the Pentagon as a rare, clear-cut victory over anti-U.S. forces, resulting in the deaths of 54 guerrilla fighters. But civilians interviewed in Samarra disputed the military's description of the clash and the death toll, with many saying that the Americans had fired indiscriminately, killing mostly civilians. The encounter, some said, had turned greater numbers of local citizens against the U.S. occupation. Jerry Reed is a Ph.D. candidate at the University of Oklahoma, whose son Cody is now serving with the U.S. military in Iraq. Ms. Reed, who is a member of the anti-war group Military Families Speak Out, talked with Between the Lines' Scott Harris about her view of the president's Thanksgiving trip to Baghdad and the dangers her son and 130,000 other U.S. soldiers continue to face daily in occupied Iraq.
He's been at the Abu Ghraib prison since early June. You know, as you may have heard on the news, this is west of Baghdad along the road between the Baghdad airport and Ramadi, where much of the violence against troops and also, you know, in reaction, the recent raids on homes and towns all through the area by the U.S. military. Luckily, Cody, he doesn't have a combat job. He isn't particularly, you know, he's not out patrolling. However, the prison has been hit. What I've heard, the commander of the prison at one time said about five times a week, by mortar fire, rocket-propelled grenades. Several prisoners there have been killed and wounded in these attacks. About a month or two ago, two soldiers were killed, and one of Cody's teammates was wounded in one of the mortar attacks. So I do think in the last month things have escalated over there, despite, you know, all these constant assurances that, you know, most of Iraq is quiet. Yeah, well, most of Iraq is not populated. It's only in the populated areas where there's violence. You know, obviously, I'm very concerned about his safety.
Upon hearing the news that President Bush visited the troops at the international airport in Baghdad for a couple hours during Thanksgiving Day, what was your reaction?
Well, I think that it was a publicity ploy. And, you know, what I've learned since then is not only was it kept secret from the press, but a lot of the soldiers, even some who were at the airport, it was a secret to them until they heard from home that, oh, yeah, George Bush had been there that day. But even like my son did not know he was there until I talked to him in the evening on Thanksgiving. And another friend of mine, her son is in the 1st Armored, which is one of the groups that supposedly had dinner with him, and he's at the airport, and he didn't know about it either until she told him. You know, I don't know why there's been this media frenzy that this, you know, helped his troops' morale, and he was so brave by going over there. I mean, if people are that gullible that they're going to think, you know, these guys are sitting over there in an increasingly dangerous situation. They've been gone for months. They really are ready to come home. To think that George Bush is going to go over there and serve a couple of turkeys and it's going to boost morale, it's a little ridiculous.
Your son, when he heard about George W. Bush's visit to Iraq, was his morale boosted? What was his reaction?
Like many soldiers, he's extremely angry at George Bush. You know, he didn't express any interest in shaking his hand. I'll just leave it at that. George Bush has constantly tried to identify himself with U.S. soldiers because, you know, he knows. Regardless of how people feel about the war, there's great concern for young soldiers who are in the middle of it. There's concern for their safety. And he's really attempted to constantly connect himself with this as if, you know, the risks they're facing are risks that he personally is facing, as if any actions that they take are somehow actions that he's took. And, you know, George Bush is a well-known chicken hawk. A lot of veterans are very angry when he does these kind of things because, you know, it's well known that he avoided the service, basically went AWOL. And, you know, he's not taking any risk himself. He's willing to put the risk on our kids over there, continuing to taunt the people who are attacking U.S. forces, you know, with his famous bring 'em on words and the idea that no matter what they do, we'll stay there. I don't think the Iraqi people are being helped. I think that the soldiers are there to protect themselves, and they send in new divisions in order to protect the soldiers that are already there. And what's the purpose of that? It's not helping people in Iraq. It's just merely perpetuating the violence.
Jerry Reed, what does your son tell you about the general situation of morale for U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq?
I think this is really mixed. You know, some soldiers, you know, I'm sure were very happy to see George Bush. At the same time, I was in Germany. He got one of those leaves, and I went to Germany to see him a couple weeks ago, and I was able to talk to both him and other soldiers. They're not going to reenlist in the Army. They said they think of getting out of the Army constantly. They think about leaving Iraq. It hasn't been a good experience for them. I'm sure people may have heard about the battle at Samarra, which has now become quite controversial. But you have all these young people put in the situation, the same as they were in Vietnam, of getting in the middle of firefights with people who may be civilians, maybe not. You know, I don't think that the facts of this incident have really surfaced, but I feel for those young soldiers because right now they're finding a way to cope with it, but years down the road, they're going to know they've been in situations that were just wrong and that they participated in them. And, you know, they'll have to deal with that for the rest of their lives.
That was Terry Reed, a member of the group Military Families Speak Out, whose son is currently serving with U.S. occupation forces in Iraq. Visit the group's websites at www.mfso.org or www.bringthemhomenow.org. In the final days before members of Congress left Washington for the holiday recess, the Senate blocked an omnibus energy bill that was packed with $23 billion in corporate tax breaks over 10 years. The vast majority of the money was targeted to energy industries, encouraging development of coal, gas, and oil resources. One component of the bill would have abolished the Public Utility Holding Company Act and mandated a further reduction of government oversight of the electricity sector. An impressive coalition of grassroots groups, from anglers, hunters, and public health advocates to communities of faith and dozens of environmental organizations, helped stiffen the Senate's spine to oppose the bill. The legislation finally died, according to opponents, because of the flood of industry-friendly provisions. The Republican effort to pass the bill was doomed when House Majority Leader Tom DeLay refused to remove a provision protecting the makers of MTBE from costly lawsuits. MTBE is a toxic fuel additive proven to have contaminated the water supply in many parts of the country. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Winona Howder, Director of Public Citizens Energy and Environment Program. She explains how an earlier energy bill set the stage for the recent debate and what grassroots groups need to do to prevent the GOP-controlled Congress from passing what many view as a similarly harmful energy bill in the near future.
The last major energy legislation was in 1992, and before that it was in 1978. And in 1992, there was some amazing agreement and much less opposition to the Energy Policy Act.
What were the main points in that legislation, and who supported that and who opposed it?
Well, I think that probably many organizations didn't realize some of the impacts of the Energy Policy Act, because it did have some benefits for renewable energy, for alternative vehicle fuels, for energy efficiency. But it had the impact of opening the door for deregulation. And so there were things that were very technical that people didn't necessarily understand. For instance, it allowed more types of unregulated companies to generate and sell electricity, and created this wholesale electricity market that was one of the first markers for electricity deregulation. It also repealed part of the Public Utility Holding Company Act, and this later, in fact, allowed Enron to be an unregulated company that generated and sold electricity. There were also tax breaks, or expanded tax breaks for domestic oil and gas producers that had environmental impacts here in the United States, and it gave substantial rewards for producers of alternative fuels. Now, many of these promises that alternative fuels were going to begin to replace conventional fuels, they just haven't come about. In fact, they just a very small percentage of alternative fuels are sold in this country, but that was a major selling point in the farm states and amongst groups that were supporting alternative fuels. There were also tax breaks for renewable energy, and there was a 1.5 cents incentive for biomass, geothermal, wind, and solar electricity, which made it very feasible for some of the renewable energy development that we've seen in states like Minnesota and Texas. And then there was also an incentive for public utilities and county governments to build some alternative electricity units.
On balance, then, it sounds like the energy bill in 1992 may have had more positive aspects as well as negative aspects compared to this bill that was just defeated, which seemed to be much heavier on the negative side.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the giveaways and the pork in this year's bill are unprecedented.
Along with the billions in subsidies for non-renewable forms of energy in this bill that just was defeated, the bill did contain a much smaller amount to support tax credits and to continue existing tax credits for things like wind power generation and perhaps other forms of renewable energy. Now that the bill is dead, how will wind and other forms of renewable energy fare?
Well, I think that they would not have fared well if the bill passed because these tax incentives and the continuation, they've helped develop renewables, but there have been a number of other contributing factors. So I think it's unfortunate, and it will stunt renewables to a degree, but I think that the negative aspects of the bill so outweighed the positive aspects that its defeat will actually be better for renewables in the long run. For instance, the repeal of the Public Utility Holding Company Act.
And that repeal was an element of the bill that was defeated, so in fact that is not repealed.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
The repeal would give much more influence and power to electric utilities and, in fact, allow industries like oil, for instance, ExxonMobil or Chevron could own electric utilities. And I think in the long run that the consolidation in the industry would hurt renewables, and certainly energy efficiency was almost completely left out of this bill, which is what is so outrageous.
The Republicans in Congress and in the White House have vowed to bring the bill back. What changes do you think would guarantee its passage? Do you think that taking certain pieces out of it would enable them to still get a bill passed, an energy bill that is still not very friendly to the environment and to renewables?
Well, I do. I think that one of the dangers is that we may see pieces of this bill. I don't think that the energy interests who wrote this bill, probably as part of Cheney's Energy Task Force, are going to give up. I think they're going to redouble their efforts in an election year, and we're going to have to do a lot of work to ensure that this bill does not come back in different forms.
That was Winona Howder of Public Citizen's Energy and Environment Program. For more information, call Public Citizen at area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.publiccitizen.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer-Cusino, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.